Hi, this is Dee Blick. Welcome to Lead Well, Live Well for UK Health Radio. Hello and a warm welcome to Lead Well, Live Well on UK Health Radio, the world's biggest talk health radio station with me, your presenter Dee Blick. Thank you so much for joining me. It's lovely to have your company. Now, in the studio today, I have a really lovely woman. She's a co-founder of a thriving franchise network. The other founder is her husband, Dan. I love the fact that she's on a mission to tear up the franchise rule book and to be a positive disruptor. Not only is she great to be around for her infectious, positive attitude, she also has a French bulldog called Winston. I have to say that on its own makes her my ideal guest for Lead Well, Live Well, given my love of all things Frenchies. So I'm delighted to welcome Kat Robson Scarborough from the Your Man with a Van franchise. Welcome, Kat.
Oh, thank you so much, Dee. I'm sorry Winston's not here with us, but thank you so much for having me.
Oh, where is he today?
Well, because he tends to snore at my feet, not ideal for interview, he is at doggy daycare today with his friends.
Oh, you know, we've got a little Frenchie in the family called Smithy, and I wrote a column about him at the weekend, and I've given up. He comes over every week, and I don't do radio recordings on a Wednesday for the exact reason he will bark his head off when a leaf blows across the drive, or he'll be snoring at my feet. So little Winston's at doggy daycare.
He is. He'll have a great time. He'll come back exhausted.
He will. Before we talk about Your Man with a Van, which I'm absolutely fascinated by, and how you've grown it to like 63 franchisees in 2 years, which in the current climate is astonishing. I'm going to chat more about that as we go further into the show. Just tell me a bit about you and your career before you became a franchisor of Your Man with a Van.
Well, it wasn't a natural lead into franchising. As a young adult, I guess, I actually always wanted to go into politics. And I know, surprising. But then I got distracted by a very beautiful pair of red shiny stilettos in a shop window. And I was never one to follow a normal route. So I decided instead of going to a standard uni, I would work in retail. So I got to work with the shiny shoes and study at the same time. So I loved retail so much because I'm a massive people person and I have really high standards. I also happen to like the shoes, the clothes, etc. But my focus was always on getting the people right, making people the best that they could be, helping them to be everything that they wanted to achieve, basically. And at the same time, yes, I was studying a degree with the Open University, and I did it in half the time that it would normally take. So I didn't really have a life while I was doing that, but I just loved every minute. And my aim was to be a head of retail by 30. And somehow I got there. Just pure grit, hard work, people focus. And anyone that has been in retail or hospitality, you know that you have to juggle people, finance, products, service, your hats are many things. So that really set me up for heading into the world of franchising in some ways.
Wow. Just going back to the red shoes, did you still have them? Did you keep them as some kind of symbol? What happened to them?
Do you know, it's really bizarre. They were in a side panel in a big department store, and they were just the most beautiful. I can see them right now, the most beautiful, glossy, red high shoes. I never bought them, but it was just like a sign, you know? It was just something in me that said, I want to work, I want to do, I want to get experience, I want to learn. And at the same time, you know, I can earn some money whilst I'm studying. So, yes, blame it all on the red shoes, hey?
That is just absolutely fascinating as a symbol. I just love it. And you were speaking about people and that you wanted to really make people the best that they possibly could be. Is that just a natural instinct of yours as a human being that you go through life and that's what your modus operandi is?
Yeah, do you know, I think it may well be my dad was actually a change manager. So he was really people focused, and he ended up doing that internationally. And he always says to me, the apple never falls far from the tree. And I'd just always been a people person. I could see the opportunity for people, but I also wanted to understand what they wanted, but also, you know, I draw the line. So I help people to see that sometimes, you know, you need to be firm and then you can put structure in place and then you can move forward.
I really like how you mentioned about your dad there. I had a guest on the show that we both know, Nikki Butlin, recently, and she was sharing about her dad as well. And it got me thinking that my dad was the most amazing salesman. And I think you're right about the apple not falling far from the tree, because I'm the most salesy marketer that I'll think, I call it the hustle. I'll think nothing of picking up the phone and selling something. And it's been a massive asset to me in my career. And I guess I took that from my dad as well. But I want to now look at franchising, because I've worked with quite a few ethical franchisors and I just love your whole approach to how you treat your franchisees. But can we just look at when did the idea of franchising appeal to you? So did you like a lot of franchisors? Did you start as a small business and then realize that it had legs that you could replicate it?
Yeah, so when I first met Dan, he had been the single man with a van, your man with a van, for over a decade. And he had got to the point where expansion was either going to be having multiple vans or potentially another way, i.e. franchising. Now, I had a little bit of experience within retail because some of the brands I worked for, they were internationally franchised. So I got to see a little bit of that operation and that process. And it was an opportunity as well to give an opportunity to others. And what I mean by that is if we could do it the right way, then we would be enabling more people to join a brand and a business that genuinely cared about them and wanted them to succeed. So when we started to research franchising, we found that there was a lot of unbalance where franchisors were taking lots of profit, lots of money, long-term commitments from franchisees, and the franchisees weren't necessarily succeeding. And that just felt really, really unfair. So we started this model to be truly accessible, really flexible for people. We're all humans. And we genuinely do. I know a lot of companies say, oh, we care. Yeah, we care about our people. But we genuinely do. We're on the phone with them. We're asking how their wives are, their children are. You know, we want to know about them and we help them to achieve what they want to achieve. They don't have to achieve our KPIs except for things like customer service standards. But they want to do that anyway because it's their business and it's their baby. So yeah, that was how we got there.
You know what I really appreciate about that answer, Kat, is the two things that came out to me there. One was proof of concept. So Dan basically had shown that this business model worked. He'd been doing it for many years. He'll have had the war stories. He'll know the ups and the downs. And you've actually got something then that you can shape into a blueprint for franchisees to follow. And I would say like a decade of doing it is absolutely brilliant, because in that time, he will have experienced everything. But what I also really love is that you talked about giving the opportunity to others. And I know as a businesswoman, that's been how I've worked within my business and with clients, that if you come at it from how can I help them to succeed rather than grasping this is what I want, then you invariably, inevitably, you actually get what you want, because like you said, people want to succeed and they also respect your mission. which is not about we want to make as much money as possible and to pile it high and sell it cheap. We actually want you to succeed as well. And I really, really appreciate that, because I've worked with, I wouldn't mention who, but franchisors where they were so grasping and it was very much a them and us situation, like the franchisor in the head office looking upon the franchisee as the enemy. The ones that I have gone on to work with, like I was telling you before we started recording, Raring to Go, which Freddie St. George bought as a franchise, and he's just like you. He came at it from, how can I help my franchisees to succeed? How can I also give them a democratic voice? Because I know with franchising, often the franchisees are just told, this is what you're doing, you know, suck it up, buttercup, you ain't got any choice here. And so I really love your ethos and your mission. Now, we're coming up to a short break, but don't go away, because after the break, I'm going to be asking Kat about the challenges, the early challenges that she faced as a franchisor and the wins that kept her motivated.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Lead Well, Live Well with me, Dee Blick, and I've got the lovely Kat Robson-Scarborough today in the studio. And Kat, welcome back. And I want to ask you, because every business, no matter what their vision and values, and faces challenges. So what were the early challenges that you faced as a franchisor? Because you went from Dan and his van to your man with the van. So tell me what you, the challenges, and also I'd love to know the wins that kept you motivated.
So I guess the biggest challenge sort of revolves around confidence and having the confidence to promote your own product. And I'm sure any business owner or anybody that sold something can relate to that. We actually started by employing a franchise consultant and working through the process with them. But we actually found that they just wanted to create a cookie cutter replica of franchises that were already out there. And to us, that really wasn't the way that we wanted to do it. So despite investing a chunk of money, despite everybody else doing it one way, Dan and I had a lot of soul searching and then said, no, we can't do it that way. We need to do it the right way. So having the confidence to literally swim against the tide and build the franchise from the ground up, us two, with our skills and our knowledge and our energy and our passion, but also to learn as we went. You know, we learned so much along the way from the great people that were being recruited, from all the conversations we were having. So, but it really was in those early days, it was having the confidence to say, yes, this is our product. And when people said, oh, that doesn't, you know, that doesn't sound like all the other franchises, or, but that sounds too good to be true, to have the confidence to say, yes, because it works and we genuinely are good people. And we want to recruit other good people to then benefit from that and to join us on this journey. You know, we're not perfect. We've got loads of things to learn, but we want to have that great network of people. So just having the confidence to do that and to keep going through that.
That's so important. And we'll come on to the wins in a minute. So I like the fact that you were able to sort of say to the franchise consultant, very good what you're telling us, but it's not us. And that for me as a marketer is how successful brands really thrive, when they know their DNA, they know their compelling offer, and they know that they're being a little bit of a maverick, like you say, swimming against the tide. And sometimes it really does work, which it has done in your case, because again, you're propelled by this great mission of giving this opportunity to others. Tell me some of the wins that kept you motivated, because it's hard work, I know having worked in franchising, it's really putting the hard yards in, creating your operations manual, getting out there and banging the drum. So what were the wins that really kept you motivated and also thinking, you know, we are on the right path?
So I think there are two that really come to mind. The first isn't so much a single win, but it's just the level of support that we had from particularly our families, who must really think we're completely nuts, you know, quitting a director level job and just going for it with a Your Man with a Van franchise. But both sets of our parents were behind us the entire way. And we actually even moved in with both of them along our journey. You know, as 30 plus year olds, we still moved back home so that we could get the work done. But they have been so kind and supportive. But in terms of individual wins, I would say some of the most important were when the great people started to be recruited, which was from the beginning. They not only gave us the confidence that they put their trust in us, they paid financially for us, you know, they bought our product, but then they continued to respond positively to what we were saying, what we were doing. And when we started to see their results and their success, that's like the biggest win that you can ever have. It's great to sell franchises, but I love nothing more, and I know Dan's the same, than seeing on, we've got like a group WhatsApp chat for all of the franchisees in the UK, and seeing the wins posted, you know, seeing this fantastic move that's happened or a partnership that they've built. It's the most rewarding thing that you could possibly have.
That's great, because you're going back to the premise of you wanted to give a great opportunity to others. So it makes complete sense to me that your biggest joy is in seeing others succeed. And I'm exactly the same, particularly where I am now with my life, that I really want to share and give away as much of my, I call it the little filing cabinets in the Blick head. I want to share and give away as much as possible, because it's there for a reason now, which is for me to help others. And I just wanted to ask you before I want to talk a little bit more about raising standards in franchising, because that really fascinates me and how you did that. Did you go to the shows, the franchisor shows? How did you recruit those first franchisees? Because they're the ones that really are the launch pad, aren't they? Because they come on board, they start to be successful. And then, as you said, they act as a magnet for others to buy the franchise. How did you initially get those franchisees on board?
So it's a really, really interesting question, because again, the franchise consultant had said, you know, go to the shows, go on the recruitment platforms. And we looked at the shows, we did some research, we looked at the platforms, we engaged with some of them, but actually nothing delivered as well as doing our own advertising on social media.
Wow.
Yeah, so I think one of the points was, this is an affordable, accessible franchise. We're not trying to be the huge big boys. We are trying to provide an honest opportunity. And quite often the shows are very expensive. So you have to get a certain number of leads to then get to sales for it then to be worthwhile. And actually, then it becomes a bit of a pressure cooker environment. So when you're in the franchise shows, it's very sell, 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 sell. And that is not our way of doing things. If people come to us that aren't right or don't have the right values, or we genuinely don't think it's going to work for what they want, we have that conversation. You know, we don't want anyone with us that's not happy. So, yeah, we found advertising ourselves, we could really shout about our values. It was definitely a learning curve. So the advertising now is a lot stronger than it was before. But that was a process that we needed to go through. And I think that also helped us to learn even more about what we were trying to do, who the ideal person was, and who it wasn't as well. So we've found over this time, and again, that goes back to confidence, that doing it ourselves is actually the best way forward.
I love that, because again, you're leaning in completely to your authenticity. And we've got literally 1 minute before the next break, but I want you just to tell me a little bit about, you spoke about raising standards in franchising, being less focused on rules and regulations and more on nurturing. Can you share a little bit more until the break about what you mean about that? Because I know that franchising is full of rules and regulations. You've only got to look at the operations manual and the legal agreements to see that.
Yes. And I think we actually were very lucky. We have a legal partner that we worked with. And in terms of like the agreement, as an example, we wanted it to be human. So yes, it needs to protect both parties, but it also needs to just be understandable for normal human beings, accessible for people to be able to read and really get what they're coming into. We're not trying to trick people with big documents into doing things. We're genuinely laying what we have on the table and saying, is this for you?
I love that. And I think what is really testament to your success, you can say all these marvelous things, but fundamentally, in 2 years, you now have 63 franchisees, which is just incredible. And before we zoom into the break, just tell me, how do you feel? That must be a real fist pump that within 2 years you've gone from Dan's business proof of concept to suddenly there are 63 humans that are looking to you for inspiration and guidance. What did that feel like when you hit 60? Just tell me.
It always feels amazing anytime we bring anyone on board. But quite honestly, I just feel really proud and really privileged that these people have chosen to work with us and to be literally on this journey together. So it's more kind of just, I'm just really proud of them all and what we've all built together.
That's wonderful. Now, don't go away, because after the short break, I'm going to be asking Kat about how she describes herself as a leader, then going into territory that I know if you listen to my show regularly, I talk about, which is fear of failure and imposter syndrome. We're not going to miss out on Winston either. So back in a jiffy.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Lead Well, Live Well with me and the lovely Kat, who is the co-founder of the Your Man with a Van franchise. Wow, 63 franchisees. There's got to be some leadership skills in there as well, Kat. So I'd love to know, given your speaking about your democratic approach, your nurturing approach, giving this opportunity to others, how do you describe yourself as a leader?
Oh, so I am very honest and transparent. So that's the first thing. And I think people probably learn quite quickly that if they don't want to hear the answer, they won't call me. But at the same time, I am very, very caring. I genuinely want to know and understand what people's situations are, what their motivations are, and what they want to achieve. Because that's the great thing about all of our franchisees. They all have different goals and they all have different things that are like an ideal life for them, whether it's working part-time around the kids and other interests, or whether it's going for gold and having 5 vans and 10 territories, which one of our branches does, one of our franchisees do. So I like to understand people and I like them to know that I'm there for them, to listen, to coach, to support in any way that we can. But ultimately, I, as a leader, just want to help people be the best that they can be. And I will always have that honest conversation with them. I'm a very straight shooter, but yeah, I'm a people person.
That's great. And how do people react? I mean, I guess it's about setting your stall out, because I'm exactly the same as a leader with clients. They know. But I always say to them, you know what, if this is my, this was my business, this is exactly what I would do. And I've had a reputation, I've built a reputation over many years just for being plain speaky, but I care. I genuinely care about their business. I won't work with a client if I don't like their business or I can see that they're not the type that wants honest feedback. They just want that permanent, you know, I call it paw patting with the French bulldog, where you're permanently stroking them. Back to French bulldogs again. How do your franchisees react when you tell them it's straight? Are they like, oh, wow, I didn't expect that from her? Or do they take it with a good heart and gratitude?
I'd like to think so. So there's never really a conversation that somebody's not expecting. And I learned that very early on in retail, that if you sit down with someone and have a conversation and suddenly they go, oh, I didn't know any of that, then you're not doing your job right, you know. And I'm not their boss. I'm not their manager. I am there to guide, support based on the structure and the success that we've had and the model that we have. And I guess from my point of view, it's also being able to read the situation. Sometimes people just need listening to. And yeah. I don't necessarily have to paw pat them, but it is just listening to them and letting them and helping them to get their thoughts out. Because all of these guys, they're all business owners. You know, they all want to do the best for their business, the best for their customers, the best for their community. And so we're on the same side. And I think just over time, we build up that trust together. So they know that I am fighting in their corner. I'm never fighting against them. I'm always fighting for them and with them. And I really hope that they all know that.
Yeah, I think that's just a great philosophy as a leader, that you're there to nurture them and support them, but also to tell them when they're going off track. And I think the three words there, I'm not their boss. Well, it's four words. That's an important thing for franchising, because often there's this misconception that franchising is about franchisor boss, excuse me, and franchisees employees. And I know that with some franchises, the way that the model is structured in terms of lead generation, which can be a head office initiative, that in most cases, excuse me, I've got a frog in my throat. In most cases, the franchisee is buying a blueprint. They're not buying a boss situation. And I have actually found with some franchisees, when I used to recruit them for a particular brand, I would have to turn down the ones who literally just wanted a boss. They wanted a more benevolent employer, which that's not the case. And so I think you saying that is a really important realization for any franchisee. It's almost like you're buying into a partnership where there's an existing business blueprint, and it's your job as the franchisor to share that. So I really like and I also endorse your philosophy as a leader. And I just want to probably a bit more on the same theme about, for many women that I speak to, that we have fear of failure and we have imposter syndrome. I know that I tick both those boxes big time. I've had to work through it over the years. And believe you me, there are days when I have to work through it from the ground up. Again, is fear of failure, imposter syndrome, does that feature in your language or not?
All the time. All the time. And I was reflecting on this topic with Dan recently, actually, because, you know, we've scaled really quickly. We didn't necessarily expect the success that has happened to your man with Van over the last couple of years. And we constantly question ourselves, constantly. But I've come to the conclusion that I think actually it's normal to have imposter syndrome and to have that fear of failure. And what that tells me is, yes, I need to be kinder to myself. A very dear friend of mine said to me, would you say what you're saying to yourself to your best friend? Yeah. And if the answer is no, then don't say it to yourself, because your brain, you know, you are the person that you listen to the most. But I think you've just, because I worry about failing and because I worry about making sure everything is as good it can be for everybody else, it's only because I care and I care so much. And I guess the danger with that is that I don't care about myself as much as I care about everybody else. But I genuinely think it's normal and we should just embrace talking about it. The feeling in the body, in the mind, when you're anxious versus excitement, chemically, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
So if you just rephrase it from feeling, I'm feeling terrified about doing this interview, oh, I'm feeling really excited about doing this interview. It's just having that shift, and it's really hard to do on your own. So I am very grateful for having a partner like Dan that we can bounce off of and pick each other up. But I feel like it's normal.
I agree with you, Kat. And it's interesting because this morning I've been away for a long weekend with my brother who lives quite away from me. And this morning I felt genuinely nervous. I thought, oh gosh, I've got two shows, which is great. But I felt quite nervous, and I sort of messaged Lucy Pitts, who's my partner in crime. And she said, you know what, babe, because we call each other babe, of course, as you do. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, excitement. Look upon it as excitement. And also you might feel a bit out of the driving seat because you've been away for a little while. And you're so right that I have to constantly think, what's going on here? Am I really terrified, or am I just excited and a little bit apprehensive? And it's quite natural to be like that. And I also identify so much with you saying that from your mate. I say that to other people. Be kinder to yourself. You know, the voice that you give to others, that empathetic, nurturing voice, spare it for yourself as well. Don't just dish it out. Look at it inwardly. But it's for me, and I guess it sounds like it's the same for you. It's just something that I work at on a daily basis. When I get up, I have to think, okay, if I'm going to do something big today, I need a few positive affirmations. I need to remind myself that I am doing my best, which is very much what's coming through with you in this interview. That, and before we talk about Winston, so you've got, because of course Winston's the star of the show, we couldn't get him on here, it'd be far too noisy. You've got 63 franchisees in 2 years. That's massive growth. Are you planning on the same level of growth in the next 2 years, or are you consolidating? What's the plan for the next couple of years?
So our plan was actually to end last year with 50. That was our goal. And then our stretch target when we hit 50 was 60. And so that means we actually doubled from the previous year, because we were basically at 30 the end of the previous year. So I said to Dan, let's just double again. Let's just double again from our original target. So we're aiming for 100. You heard it here first.
Yeah.
We're aiming for 100 this year. But we have two strategies that kind of underpin that. And one is to make sure our existing franchisees are happy, successful, doing all the things that they need to do, feeling good, feeling strong. So we've got that strength under the brand. And the other side is just keeping talking about the brand and putting the awareness and, yeah, hopefully serving even more areas of the UK.
That's amazing. And I think you've hit the nail on the head that you don't want growth at the expense of your existing network.
No.
And I've seen franchisors do that, where they invest all their energy into bringing more franchisees in, forgetting that they've actually got the guys and gals that are in the here and the now. And I was interviewing Richie Clark, who is the franchisor of the Pets Homes and Gardens company, a few weeks ago. And he said the same as you. We want to grow the network, but not at the expense of looking after our existing franchisees. So let's just talk briefly about Winston, the French Bulldog. Now, you and I had a chat with you just to see if you were suitable for coming on the show, because obviously I need people that can chat. And we were chattering away, and suddenly you lifted up Winston and my heart melted, because we've got this little Frenchie in the family called Smith. I want just how has Winston contributed to well-being in the office? Because I know he is a regular, is at doggy daycare today, sadly. But how does he contribute to well-being in the office? What's his role in the operation?
He would be chief snoring officer if he had a role. He is always there, always at my feet or next to a radiator if he can help it. He's not an outdoorsy kind of dog. He loves just being with people. Although the great thing with having a dog in the office, because I've had a dog in the office in previous roles as well, which has been amazing because they make you take a break. You have to go and let them out for a toilet break. And quite often you wouldn't even do that for yourself because you get so wrapped up in what you're doing. So he makes you take a break. He's also there, you know, if you just need a cuddle or a little stroke, he's always willing to help with that. He's actually slightly separate to work, but when we went through pregnancy, we had a very, very bad pregnancy. And he spent the entire time, except when I was in hospital, he was next to my tummy the whole time. Yeah, they just, dogs know, don't they? They read you, they can feel you. And yeah, I love him. I love him to bits.
I just think they're the most gorgeous breed, French bulldogs. They are very much, in my experience, people dogs rather than doggy dogs. And Smith, when on the rare occasion I managed to prize him outside of the front door, if he encounters other dogs, no matter how big, he will be barking his head off at them. And you've got this little French bulldog, then this massive bear of a dog that's so well behaved. And I'm just saying to the owner, he's more of a people dog than a doggy dog. If that fact needs saying. But no, he's just gorgeous, Winston. And that was it. Once I saw Winston, it was like, let's get you on the show. Never mind about this brilliant franchise that you've built. Let's get you on the show. So we're at the stage of the show now, Kat, where I want you to share a quote that inspires you. And then you're going to flick the switch and ask me a question. I haven't got a clue. This is where I get a bit, oh my goodness me, but share a quote that inspires you before you ask me your question.
So I love quotes. There are so many out there, but there is always one that I go to if times are tough. And it's actually from a film. And it's "The night is darkest before the dawn." And it's from one of the Batman Begins films. And I clung on to that. And I really, really love that, because when you're in that place of whatever's happening, whatever's going on, it feels very dark. But if you remember that it is darkest before the dawn, then you know that there's that bit of hope.
Absolutely. Oh, that's a lovely quote, and something that's quite easy to remember and also to identify with. What's your question for me?
I had so many questions to ask you. I had to pick one. And I'm sorry to bring it back to AI, because I'm sure people are probably a little bit sick of AI. But I wondered, with all of your knowledge and everything that you see and hear from authors, what do you think the impact is of AI on in terms of the skills of developing new authors and the new breeds that's going to come through?
I think that's a great question. And I think we need to look upon AI, as authors, we can look upon AI as a really useful tool that might be able to help us inspire our writing. That also with research, AI is fantastic. So if we look upon it as a tool, then I think it's got immense value. However, if we think that we can create a book using AI, and I have seen this advertised, I think we're going down a slippery slope. And my view on that is, if you want to create a book that's been generated by AI, that should be a sticker on the book, because I'm not buying the author's authentic voice. So I'm obviously talking here about nonfiction books, like business books, which is what I specialise in writing. I think as well that I'm also a commissioning editor for a big media brand, and I have several contributors. And the one thing that I've said to every contributor is I want your authentic voice, because your authentic voice has got your quirks, it's got your experience, it's got your character, and it makes you different from everybody else, because nobody can take away your authentic voice. When I have seen columns that have been largely written by AI, I can tell, and I call it the bleaching of the brand. It's when you are sacrificing your charm, your unique voice and your experience for the ease of AI. And I think what we're going to see is there'll be this surge of some authors going into AI with their arms wide open. And there will equally be a lot that are standing against it or just using it to help with their research and to inform their writing. And inevitably, it will peak, then it will fall, and we'll then go back to the, oh, isn't it lovely to have a book that's not full of AI? So I'm not a Luddite. I'm not a person that says, oh, it's dreadful. I think AI is absolutely wonderful. I use it. It's great for research. It's great for even things like when I'm interviewing somebody for giving me an idea of questions. But the day that we start to use AI as us, so in effect, we become the bot. We're the bot. We're the ones that are effectively a custodian of the AI. Then as authors, we lose out. And I think this will go round, and eventually people will bristle against it. At the minute, it's all the emperor's new clothes. And as a marketer, I'm all for it. As an author, I'm like, use it with extreme care, but never sacrifice your beautiful, authentic voice. How does that sound, Kat? You got me on the spot there.
Thank you. Thank you so much, dear. It's so interesting to hear, though, with your years of experience.
Yeah. Oh, well, we've now actually come to the end of your bit on the show. So thank you for joining us today, Kat. I have loved chatting to you. So it's great to see you. Thank you. Now, I want to turn the attention on to you, my lovely listeners, with my today's final thoughts. I want to ask you today, which voice is the loudest at the moment in your head? Is it the critical one that waits to pounce when you make even the slightest of mistakes? Or is it that warm, nurturing and encouraging voice, the one that tells you that you're doing just fine, you're doing brilliant even? I know, based on what Kat and I was chatting about, that I'd hazard a guess that sometimes the critic is often ruling the roost and silencing your positive, supportive voice. So I'd like you to pay closer attention to that nurturing voice and to start making a conscious effort to mentally reward yourself when you accomplish anything, no matter how small. By all means, acknowledge the critical voice, but then dismiss it, because it's of no support or benefit to you whatsoever. I know from experience it's so easy to get caught up in a hamster wheel where, through habit, a lack of challenging your inner critic, you actually allow it to remain unchallenged. I want you to make a firm resolve to not only be kinder to yourself, just as Kat and I was chatting about, but I want you to pat yourself on the back much more often, to be your own cheerleader and not your harshest critic. So until next week, this is me, Dee Blick, signing off. And again, thank you so much for joining me. And by all means, get in touch and let me have your comments and thoughts on my shows. Until next week, goodbye.
You've been listening to Lead Well, Live Well on UK Health Radio.